Hey everyone, it's the Lady J. Thanks so much for tuning into my new podcast, I Never Told You What I Do for a Living. This week, I had a conversation with my friend Mike, who lives in the UK, and he's a professional carer. This is a really great conversation, and we actually talked for so long that this is the first part of a two-parter episode. So you'll hear the second half of my conversation with Mike next week. This first episode is about Mike's career trajectory from the first time that he had a caregiving job through to what he does now. There is a portion of this conversation where we talk about the first few times that Mike experienced losing a patient on the job. So just a little bit of a warning there that we do talk about people passing away and what that process is like. As someone who has experience with caregiving, both as a caregiver for a loved one and for that loved one to receive professional care, I think this conversation is really important. And I hope that people who can give this a listen and really think about the industry of caregiving and nursing homes and people growing older, a lot of these conversations people don't want to have, but they're really important. I'm going to skip over the normal section where I tell you where to contact me. We can do all that stuff at the end because I really just want to dive into this conversation. So this is episode 3 of I Never Told You What I Do for a Living with Mike, the carer. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very relaxed. I'm having a lovely day off.
Oh, that's nice. I'm also having a lovely day off, but not because it's my day off, because it's a national holiday here.
Because America, because Will Smith punched an alien and now your whole country gets to relax.
I thought it was more that we threw off you guys and said absolutely no more tea ever.
Oh, yeah,
tea is actually illegal in this country.
That's a good point. Why am I talking to you today? This is going to be Oh, no.
Well, yeah, we've made a horrible mistake here.
I have left my brown coat in the wardrobe. You're safe for now.
Good. Excellent. My first question for you is, what did you want to be when you grew up when you were little?
Oh, there's a variety there. When I was very little, I wanted to be a tractor.
Fair.
Because I didn't understand anything. And then I pretty much wanted to be Arnold Schwarzenegger in the film Last Action Hero, because I liked his boots. And then I grew up a bit and I wanted to be a firefighter. And that stuck. Forever, probably because of a TV show over here called London's Burning, which I really, really liked. And I really wanted to be a firefighter. I was hellbent on it. I thought that's it for me. But then I found out you have to have 20/20 vision, because if you wear glasses or contact lenses, they will melt onto your face and eyes. So that was the end of that, because my eyesight is a mess. So I didn't do any of that.
So I have to ask now, have you ever seen the movie Little Miss Sunshine?
Yes.
Was finding out that you couldn't be a firefighter because of your vision like Paul Dano finding out that he couldn't fly airplanes because he was colorblind?
Yeah, a bit. It was very, yeah, I was very sad about it, because it was like, that was what I wanted to be for about 7 years. And then I found out through the TV show, I was watching the show that I love, and then I realized, you know, and then because it's you know, a drama, but it's very real. And I was really, really glum for a while. And then my mum sort of talked me around by saying she never wanted me to be a firefighter because, you know, scary stuff. And I got over it. But yeah, no, I was really moody for a little while, because that's all I really wanted. And it's weird because I wanted it, but I never really did anything about it. I was too young to be like training to be a firefighter or anything or whatever. But, you know, that was where I thought I'd go. And then I just sort of changed. Nothing at school was leading towards it. All of my, you know, school classes, courses, college, etc., was all, you know, writing and drama based. So it was never really a plan I was actively chasing. It was just sort of, that's what I want to do.
So how old were you when you found out that you couldn't be a firefighter?
Probably about 14, 13 or 14, something like that. Yeah, I decided I wanted to be a firefighter when I was about 8.
Okay. So you said that when you were at school, though, you were studying writing and drama.
Yeah. By then, for UK classes, by the time you get to 60, I mean, then I was still doing normal, you know, every class that you have to go to because of the curriculum. But by like 15 or 16, I started choosing, you get to drop certain things. So like, I immediately got rid of things I don't care about, like geography, and whittled it down to like art, drama, or theatre studies, as it was called, but you know, drama, art, drama, English language and literature, things like that.
And so what did you think you might do with all that stuff at that age?
Become a writer that I never actually finished up on. I can sum it up very quickly. At college, that's when I sort of became quite obsessed with film. I had a couple of really good tutors for my media studies and film studies classes, and they really, really brought out sort of the best in me. And my English language and literature teacher made me really love poetry. And then I started writing quite a lot. And I, you know, at that age, you kind of assume, okay, well, I'll just win Oscars then. That's what I'll do. I'll write stuff and win Oscars. Instead of being a firefighter as a backup plan. And then I love being on stage. I hosted everything at school. I was always like the compere if they had competitions, and I really liked doing assemblies, and I was in all the school plays, and I really enjoyed the performance bit, but I was rubbish at learning lines, so I was always really anxious about that. So I decided maybe the stage, even though I've got the ego for being front and center, maybe I don't have the talent. So I loved writing. I still write short stories. I still write weird little, you know, weird little like twist in the tail kind of mystery things, but just as a hobby. And I was sort of focused on that all the way through college, right up until 18. Everything was sort of geared towards that. And then I applied to university. I got into Manchester Metropolitan University, decided to take a gap year, and in that gap year, to make some money, I started working at a children's home, and I've been doing care. I never actually went to uni. I've been doing care work ever since.
What made you take the job at the children's care home during your gap year?
I finished college. I started working at a supermarket near my house, just, you know, stacking the fruit and veg, and I quickly realized I'm not going to make a huge amount of money, and I'm really, really bored. And there's nothing wrong with that work. I would quite happily do it again if it was the work that I needed to do, but I didn't, you know, 18, I wasn't feeling it, shall we say. Mm-hmm. One of my best friend's dads was the manager of this children's home a little bit outside of my hometown, like this old converted manor house that was pretty cool. And it had children living there and living in houses around the community with carers present, you know, 24 hours. And it was sort of a boarding school slash care home for children with quite extreme behavioural issues that had brought them out of their own homes, whether they were from difficult families or they were problematic in themselves and their families weren't coping, or usually a pretty unhealthy mix of the two. He is always desperate for staff because, as you can imagine, the staff turnover is quite high in places like that because of burnout, because it is a very emotionally draining job and quite physically demanding. You can get beaten up quite a lot by these teenagers. But he suggested I come with him one day and see if I liked it. I was 18. The eldest children that lived there were 16. Some of them were bigger than me. It was not a great idea, but I really enjoyed doing it. I'm glad I did it. I don't think I'd do it again. And I think in hindsight, I was too young to have any kind of impact. I was sort of really just floating around panicking and just sort of not being particularly in charge of the situation at any given time. But I did find that I love working with people, and I found a hard day at work had a really strange sense of satisfaction on my way home, even if the hard day had involved getting my ass kicked, which did happen a few times because, you know, they were violent. My first day, he drove me in to the grounds, and it was, as I say, this old converted manor house, and it had like a boys' wing and a girls' wing, and the girls' wing was on fire and the boys were all on the roof and throwing furniture and things at the staff cars in the car park. And that was my first day. And I've had a history since then of my first day anywhere being terrible. It's just it's just lingered. But after a year, I had a really nasty encounter with a kid who, not his fault, there was a set of circumstances that led to him being very agitated that day. And I was one-to-one with him, and he gave me a bit of of a stab, and I left. I thought, I don't really like getting stabbed. Only in the hand, nothing serious, but, you know, it was enough.
And then how long was it before you worked as a carer again after that?
My next job. I realized I liked care, but I thought, children, I need to work somewhere. I'm not comfortable with it. As it turns out, another friend of mine, in fact, sort of a friend of my mum's, one of our neighbors, she worked nights at a care home for adults. Not the elderly yet, which has become my bread and butter for my whole adult life, but I would have been, say, 19 and a half, and she recommended I come and have an interview at this place. It only had 14 residents. They were all men. The age range was sort of 18 to about 50. And in the old days, they would have probably called it something like a halfway house. That's not the term anymore for various politically correct reasons, but a home for people with learning difficulties, some disabilities, and just people who would be sort of vulnerable in the community on their own. And it was lovely. It was wonderful. That's where I clicked. That's where care work became the thing for me. That was also where I went over my time to be going to Manchester University. And I think I was a bit scared of uni life and the concept of putting myself in a massive amount of debt. And I was enjoying what I was doing. And I thought, well, you know, I'm still young. If in a couple of years I want to reapply, I can reapply. And I just never did. I just carried on with the care work. I was at that second place for about 3-4 years, and I just loved it. It's where I got my first promotion, where I went from being a carer to a senior carer. So I was administering medication and leading the shift, designating staff. I went onto the on-call system. Really loved. I only left because I moved out of my hometown. I moved away, so that's when I left. But that's definitely where I caught the bug for care. A very gothic woman who looked a bit like Robert Smith, who worked there. Who was my main source of inspiration. She was just excellent. And she taught me a lot about temperament and how to lead without seeming like you're being bossy, and how to sort of convince the kids to do something. I say kids, I mean, they were adults, but some of them sort of mentally were not thinking like adults. There was a lot of very juvenile behavior, and trying to sort of get them to think that they came up with the idea to do something good and productive with their day, because there was a lot of nothing going on. I mean, house of 14 men with no jobs, some having like a couple of days in college, some working at a local car wash. You know, there was a lot of just nothing going on. You had to try and fill the days, convince them to come out of their room and, you know, not just be isolated, because that's worse. And she really taught me how to sort of be the person to get people on board doing something that when they'd rather just, you know, not. And that was relevant with the clients, but it also became relevant as a team leader with the staff, who sometimes were just as difficult to sort of push in the right direction as the lads who lived there. A strange job, but I really enjoyed it. And it's what got me going with care.
So then when you moved to a new town, did you immediately start looking for work doing something similar?
I did, but I also took a temp job in a call center, because I moved to Manchester anyway, regardless of the fact that I wasn't going to uni there. That's where I moved. And I took a job that I could start like the next day, you know, through an agency at a call center, just to make some money, and then started looking at care homes in the area, working out where I could get to from where I lived. I applied a few places, but I found that the majority of care I could see in the area was elderly care, which I hadn't done, and I wasn't sure if I could do. But the first place that offered me an interview was a home specifically for people with schizophrenia, a lot of whom had been homeless and been sort of had some awful histories. And I did a day there and was frankly terrified. It was sort of these poor people, but the system was not on their side. You know, that house was a nightmare. You shouldn't just bunch people together by mental illness and just shove them all in a house. It breeds a lot of problems. So I quite glad I didn't stick that one out. And then the next day I got an offer for an interview that I got at a pretty small care home, predominantly for Polish clients in Manchester. And that's sort of where I really found my calling, because the elderly and I just clicked. That was it. I enjoyed being there for them. I enjoyed listening to them. I enjoyed finding it. I mean, as you can imagine, with that age range and that country of origin, there were some pretty tough lives. You know, a lot of people running away or being taken by family abroad during the war, and a lot of people who had lost a lot. And it was, I mean, there were 14 or 15 residents. 13 of them were Polish. Most of them barely spoke English. Most of the carers were Polish. And I think because of that, because they were sort of a minority in the area, looking after people who were from their home country, I really, really picked up on this sort of sense of sort of family duty and how personal you could let the job be and still be okay. And I was the only, and I was one of three British people who worked there. I was the only man. And I just, especially the way the Polish carers looked after these Polish elderly clients in a way that was just so loving and so personable. And, you know, they were professional, but you could tell they adored these people and looked up to them. And I think it's part of the culture over there. There aren't really care homes in many countries around. Well, there probably are now, but at the time, you said that, you know, if your grandparents grow old, they move in with you. That's how it is over there. And it's probably not anymore, but that's how it was. You know, this was like 15 years ago or more. And I just felt like I had the right temperament to do what they were doing. And I really loved it. It was also where I dealt with my first deaths. The first one was horrible, but I did, like, when I went home after getting beaten up by the kids, I went home with a very strange sense of satisfaction that I had seen somebody off properly and that I did my job well. And I couldn't even count the amount of clients at this point. I mean, I've been in elderly care since I was about 22 and I'm now 35. So there's been a lot of people pass away along the way. And I've always found that side of the job is where I'm most proud of what I do, because you only get to die once and we'd better not fuck it up. And because the first two or three were really hard, I hadn't actually had any training in it yet. I'd had the basic training, you know, moving and handling training, so I could safely use hoists and machinery, a little bit of training on dementia awareness, but absolutely nothing on, and they, to this day, they still don't really offer full-on courses for the average carer who's just doing their caring job in like brief counselling and dealing with the families. And the first chap who died, I got on duty and he had already passed away in the night. And the carers on duty were all so busy dealing with that, and the manager had to go out for something else. They basically just sat me in a room with his daughter. And that was my job for about 3 hours, just to sit with this woman who just got there and her dad had died. And we ended up talking about dancing, because she was a dancer. Not a dancer, but we danced together because I couldn't think of anything else to do because I was in full on panic mode the whole time. But I just thought, you can't take somebody's mind off it. But I don't even know her dad that well. I haven't worked there very long. I don't know what else to do. So she understood, you know, what I was sort of trying to do was just have her think about other things while we were waiting for the coroner and the undertakers and stuff. And the next death, I'm not going to chronicle them all, but there are certain lessons I learned along the way. The next death was a massive Russian chap called Nikolai, and he was huge. And he died in bed, and I found out a lot about what the human body does straight after it dies, which I didn't know before. Evacuate everything that is inside it immediately. I was on with a lovely lady, very nice carer, very sweet. There's only the two of us there. You only needed two carers for that amount of clients by law. It's probably changed by now, but at the time that was. And she, even though she'd been a carer for years and was my senior, completely panicked and wouldn't help. So I washed him myself and managed to sort of roll him over and instinctively found that I would talk to him and, you know, still warn him that I was about to do things. and noticed in my own head that that's weird, but I couldn't do it in silence, and got him into fresh pajamas, ready for the undertakers to come and take him to the morgue. And it was an expected death. He was old and frail, so we didn't have to call the police or anything. The police have to be involved if it's an unexpected death, like a death from a fall or something, if they're already terminally ill. As long as they've seen a doctor relatively recently, you're all right. They will go, and it's, you know, to be expected. And then the third death was where I learned about what I'm like in a crisis, because it was a very small old lady who choked on her porridge at the breakfast table in the dining room, surrounded by everybody. And I administered the mouth to mouth. And I'm pretty sure I broke a couple of ribs trying to perform CPR because she was so small. And she died anyway. And I went with her in the ambulance to the hospital, and then walked back from the hospital because I hadn't taken my wallet with me. And that walk made me think a lot about, do I love this job or do I hate this job? Because that was a bad day. And I realized that I can do it, and I'm not going to go home and dwell on it. And I'm not going to, you know, I felt okay. And I thought a lot of people wouldn't be okay with what has just happened over the last 2 hours of their day. You know, a lot of people would not be able to brush that off. And I know that sounds a bit egotistical, but you talk to almost anybody, if you've done any level of care work, one of the first things most people say is, oh, I couldn't do that. And they're right. You know, likewise, I couldn't be a firefighter. As it turns out, I don't have that in me. I know I don't, having seen what they actually do. Yeah. So weirdly, it was through working with the clients on their last days that I realized how important that aspect of the job is to me. And so I decided that's what I want to do. This is what I want to do on that day, on that horrible day. Ugh, yeah. I even remember when the doctor came in and said that she had definitely gone. I mean, she was dead in the ambulance, but, you know, they officially called it at the hospital. And I almost felt bad at how I didn't feel that bad. I felt sorry that she'd gone, because I liked her. She was quite fun. She used to pretend she was dead. She was lovely. She'd lay there with her mouth wide open, and when you got up close, she'd go, bah! It was very funny. Her name was Genya. She was awesome. She was always trying to run away, and she lost a lot of weight along the way. And so she'd be in the garden, then her trousers would fall down, and then you just hear this little Polish uh-oh from the garden. You knew Genya had got out, and her bum was out, and you had to go and sort it out. She was like my favorite. And then I was so relieved that she was the one I was the one that was dealing with it when she went, you know, because I didn't want anybody else to deal with it. And I have been a little bit like that ever since. I have issues trusting that anyone else will get it right. So I tend to be at work a lot, because especially if a client is at end of life, you know, I'd rather go and finish my shift and sit with them for a bit than just go home. And there's not many carers I've worked with who do that. And it's not that they're bad carers, they're brilliant carers. I'm just sappy. And if anything, it's probably not a good thing. It's probably better that I could be professional and just have a cutoff point. But that, as I say, you only leave this earth once. So it was through dealing with death. God, that sounds weird, but it was through dealing with death that I realized this is something I can do and therefore should do. That was a long answer.
That was a great answer. I mean, I'll take the long answers when they're that good. Have you ever considered doing anything else? Like, has there ever been a day where you're like, you know what? I'm just going to go back to the grocery store, because...
Absolutely. I did for a bit. Not the grocery store. I worked in a hotel for a little while. I left. It was that place, actually. That same place. The sort of the Polish client's care home. I was getting increasingly frustrated that the manager, it wasn't really her fault, but she was sort of having a bit of a nervous breakdown, and her personal life was severely affecting the job. And the place got broken into a couple of times at night. One time I accidentally scared someone who broke in and robbed some of the lady I was working with, grabbed her handbag, and she just saw him in the lounge and screamed. And I ran through. At the time I was peeling potatoes for tomorrow's lunch. This is the thing about being a carer. There is so much that isn't being a carer. There's so much that is housework, kitchen work, laundry service. You know, there's so many more parts to the job. So yes, it was about 2 a.m. and I was peeling potatoes because I'm a carer. And I ran through because I thought, oh Christ, has she just fallen down the stairs and broken her back? Or what the heck? That was a scary scream. And the robber was this massive guy, looked round, saw me, and ran out the building. Now, you know what I look like. No massive guy should be looking at me and running away. But I hadn't let go of the massive knife I was peeling the potatoes with, and I didn't even realize. So, the home didn't feel safe. They were losing clients and not getting more clients. And that is the sign of a home that it doesn't want to stay open much longer. It was privately owned as well. And there's a big difference between working for a privately owned care home where it might just be a family who owns it or a businessman runs it as a business and doesn't have any background or history in care or whatever. There's a lot of that. And if they run well or if they've hired the right manager, there's nothing wrong with that. But we had a manager who was severely distracted by her own problems. So I left because I was finding what I wanted to achieve as a carer. I was being severely handicapped. There was you could not do a good job anymore in that place, and I did feel burnout, and you do every so often. It happens a lot with jobs like that. I need to go do something else. So I went and worked in a hotel for a year, and I worked with a really nice guy called Jacob, and we worked night shifts, and it was really fun, really easy. He was really into wrestling, which I am too, so Monday nights were really quiet, so we just put Sky on in the bar and watch Raw and get paid for it. And it was a good time to work there. But yeah, I only did that for about a year. And then I moved out of Manchester, less than a year, actually, maybe about 7 months. And then I moved out of Manchester and moved to the Midlands, moved to a city called Lincoln, and resurrected my elderly care. And that's where I first worked, in a nursing home where we have trained nurses there, and the management are all qualified nurses. And there are clients with much more complex medical needs because now there's a nurse. Yeah, where I was before, we were carers. I was about to say just carers, but that's insulting to my trade. It's not just carers. It was residential care. There's sort of layers to it, as you obviously know. And so I'd gone from residential care in sort of a retirement home to nursing care in a nursing home. So that's where I learned about more medical side of things, more about the medication. I mean, I had administered medication in the past at other homes, but it was more, just follow what it says on the pack. Don't think about it too much. This was where I was responsible for dealing with the pharmacy, ordering the residential client's medication. The nurses would order the nursing client's medication. And I learned that this is just a much bigger and scarier setup, and there was a lot more going on. And there were clients who required peg feeding, where they had tubes into their stomachs and nothing, nil by mouth, that everything went in there. And yeah, it was a great job. I enjoyed a lot about it there. And I only left there to work somewhere a bit nearer my house because I had to get a bus to get there, and I didn't. It was a long, not a big city, but it was like I was at one end and that home was at the other, and it was quite a commute. And then a job came up at one, a couple of minutes away from where I live, and that's the company I work for now. That's the first time I'd worked somewhere that wasn't just run by a family or run by somebody, privately. And that's where I first, so when I started working for the trust, that's where I realized that there is an industry here where you can be a part of a system that is bigger than the home and feel that support from being part of a huge team, a huge collaborative team. And that's sort of, I keep saying hit my stride, but there's been, 5 or 6 times in my life where I feel like I've learned the job again and go, oh, okay, this is what we do now, especially because legislation and rules change quite a lot along the way as well. But it was leaving the nursing home and moving to work for St. John's Care Trust, where I started working somewhere where sort of the ethos of the business matched what I was feeling personally and morally already. And I've been with them ever since. When I moved, I made sure there was a care facility owned by the trust near enough to where I was moving and just transferred.
Have you ever considered, not necessarily going back to school, but like getting other certifications?
Well, I have along the way as a carer. I've done diploma courses in health and social care and team leading and a trained moving and handling assessor and mentor. So I can train people on moving and handling equipment, hoist stand aids, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I have done it, but I've done it through work. I've done it as part of my job. I've changed course. I haven't considered going back and doing a writing course or anything. I've never had the financial stability to entertain the idea too much without ruining my life. I need full-time work. So I've never really been able to sort of find the balance, even if I did, you know, and all, I've discovered a real love for what I do. And if I do find I want to do something less physical, I'd like to continue with the training and become a full-time trainer, you know, eventually, maybe in about 10 years when my hips and my back don't want to be doing the physical side of the job anymore, because there's a lot of running around and, you know, heavy work involved in care and physically demanding. Now that I know I really enjoy standing up in front of people and telling them what to do, which actually harkens back to my days at college as a drama student, comfortable speaking in front of others is a huge boon. If you're comfortable standing in front of people and talking confidently and knowledgeably about anything, then the fact, because I've been trained by people who clearly aren't that, they've got the knowledge, but they're not great at conveying it. And it's a lot of them looking down at the paper and basically reading off the paper. They might as well have just emailed us the paper and not bothered coming. You know, we'd learn the same. It's a finding out that I've got that in me. I think if I was to do anything different now, if I suddenly was gifted the opportunity to do anything, earn a degree anywhere, I would become some form of teacher. And I should think it would probably still be within the care industry, maybe occupational therapy, rehab, teaching people safe moving and handling practices, protecting your own back, protecting your own physical well-being whilst assisting people who need help with mobility issues, you know. That's where I've sort of found a keenness at the moment. In the last couple of years, I've gone full on into that side of things. I'm the lead carer for that in my home, and I only envision doing more along those lines as time goes on.
So now I'm going to sound exactly like your mom, right? Have you not ever considered going to school to become a nurse? Because wouldn't you make more money if you were a nurse?
I would, and it's not my mum so much as every nurse I've ever worked with. I'd be a nurse. I don't really have a solid answer for that. Comfortable in what I'm doing, I suppose. Not a hugely ambitious human being as I've got older. Fear of doing a degree at 35. There's plenty of people who do it later, and, you know, that's great. I don't know how well I can learn new things at this point. Not to that degree, you know. As it stands, I don't handle injections or invasive care at all. There's nothing I do that involves piercing my client's skin or injecting them with anything. No, I give them medication that they take themselves. I won't even hold a pill in a gloved hand and pop it in someone's mouth. There is a barrier there that we can't cross in invasive care, and I'm comfortable with that. But really deep down, the reason I don't do it is I fear the job a bit. It's a much more life and death responsibility, and I like what I do. I could get paid more to do it, but I get paid enough to do this. I can get paid more to be a trainer and assessor, and I don't have to be a qualified nurse to become a qualified occupational therapist, which you can sort of learn on the job, which is probably where I'll end up over the next few years. So I do have a career trajectory. It's just much more relaxed and does not involve
stabbing people.
Not because becoming a nurse. Yeah, that moment has maybe been and gone. And I know that is a stupid thing to say, because I've still got half my working life left ahead of me in theory, but I know what I'm comfortable with, and I don't feel like I would want to do it at this point. I did vaguely entertain the idea of becoming a community nurse or district nurse, going around the care homes and doing swabs and blood tests and samples and helping people with their insulin and tissue viability, keeping people's skin clean and intact and looking after bed sores and things like that. But when you do that, you're not in the client's lives as much as you are with what I do. And it sounds crazy and maybe a bit selfish, but I like being a part of the residence life. I like the main reason that the best bits of my job are when I go to a client's flat, and I'm thinking of a couple that I look after as I say this, where I feel like part of the family because I'm there every day and I go and see these people like three times a day, and I'm their guy, you know, and there's such a lovely element of trust to that. And sometimes sexism that works in my favor, weirdly, being the only male carer where I work, there are some things that people assume a man can do better. That is just not true. I'm not even the strongest member of my team by far. I'm probably like third or fourth. There's a woman called Belinda who is like Popeye. She can, you know, she is just strong, but people assume I can do certain jobs better. And better isn't even the right word, but there are some male clients who don't really want the girls to give them a shower. There are some female clients that don't want me to give them a shower, but they do want me to do the like the cleaning of the high shelves or any furniture removals, or you know, all the stuff that in their traditional lives 50 years ago the man would do. And that's not the culture we live in now. That's not how the job works at all. But you can't really change how a 90-year-old feels about what, you know, and their preference comes first, mostly, unless it's an emergency, in which case it doesn't. But you know, it's whoever gets there. But yeah, it's, I like how involved I am with my clients. I think that's how I get the best results. And you kind of have to be based in the home yourself to get that back and forth feeling of sort of trust. And it is a two-way street. I mean, I genuinely really, really like a lot of the clients I care for as people. There's one woman in particular who I find amazing and inspiring and incredible. And she's 101 and she is the sole surviving female pilot from World War II in this country. There were only 165. And she is 101 years old and she's the last one left, and she's got her old flight logs and her brain is sharp as a tack, and she's got a super steady hand. She still does artwork, she remembers everything. I run late in on her visits. If I'm there for an 15 minutes, I'll be there for 25. I just find her super inspirational and really fun to talk to. As a nurse, I would lose that connection. If I was in a hospital, people come and go so quickly. You know, you definitely still get that connection. A lot of nurses do, but I like being sort of in their home and being a part of the daily routine of their lives. So that's sort of another part of why I've never followed up becoming a nurse.
Can we talk about your award?
Yes, I won an award. We can definitely talk about that. I was nominated for a care award, and there are five or six categories, maybe a couple more. And I didn't win carer of the year, but I won an award that I prefer, which is my way of dealing with the fact that I didn't win carer of the year. I won unsung hero of the year. And that goes to the person who is sort of the backbone of a place, you know, the person who doesn't get praise, but will do lots, you know, would really, really help. And the thing that means the most to me about winning that award last year was that I was nominated by more than one person, because it can just be your manager or a colleague nominates you and what they write is so good that you win based on that. But my manager and three clients nominated me, and you don't find that out at the time, but I found that out after the fact. And it was partly because of the fact that I agreed to have my legs waxed for charity the Alzheimer's Society. That was a bad day, but we raised like £500 for Alzheimer's research, so it was worth it. I don't know if you've ever had your legs waxed, but I found out that the moment you pull your bed sheet over you at night and it touches your brand new, completely bald skin, fuck off, does that hurt? that is insanely painful. And yeah, it was pretty crazy. What was lovely is it was done in a coffee morning. The clients like were all there, and where I work, there is a beauty therapist, well-being therapist person on site. We have a hair salon and we have essentially a chiropodist and nail salon. And she does health, beauty and nail care. And so she did the waxing and she brought her bench thing in and I laid on it. And I was wearing a pair of shorts and my uniform top. And all the clients had been sort of laughing and joking about it right up until that moment. And we'd all been, you know, especially the women that I look after, would be going, oh, you know, having a laugh at my expense. And then all of them, as soon as I laid down and the wax was on the strip and they stuck it to their leg, everyone's face has changed. And everyone looked at me like, oh my God, he's actually doing it. this is bad. And no one could look at me. I didn't cry, but when they were doing the back when they were doing like the back of my knee, I came close to punching a woman for the first time in my life. And yeah, it was pretty bad. But yeah, as I say, that was, I think, a bit of a, that was probably the thing that put me above the other contestants. And the thing is, you can have dozens of people get put forward and they whittle it down to, you know, four for the shortlist who would actually go and attend the award ceremony, which was a really nice lunch in a hotel in Oxford that myself and my manager went to. And she was nominated for something as well. Didn't win it, but you know, I did. So she's since left and she was fine, but the new manager's a lot better. Anyway, yeah. So it was really fun experience. I was very proud. It's difficult to know where is just informing people of your day and where you are coming across as egotistical when you've won an award. It's hard to, you know, but I enjoyed it that day. I milked it a bit that day and I don't really bring it up. I am because you have. It's on my CV. It's definitely going to be good when I go for a new job. You know, that's the way I look at it. It's career development and it's wonderful. And it was a very, the buffet at the award ceremony was really good. Like, that's the main thing. But yeah, it was nice. And I think it was a mixture of that and the clients who nominated me. It was because of the things I was talking about, you know, I make time to be there for them and their families. And I enjoy, I know this does sound egotistical, but it's important to feel good about what you do for a living. And I know I'm popular amongst the clients, you know, and that's a good feeling. I don't want to be ringing their doorbell and walking into their little apartment and they go, oh no, he's here, you know. And there are no carers where I work who are bad carers, and there are no carers who are bad people, because it takes a certain type of person to do the job in the first place, in my opinion. Where I work now, I mean, there have been bad carers, you know, in the past, but where I work now, we've got a really nice bunch. But I enjoy being sort of near the front of the pack there. I'm not the best carer in the building. That's a woman called Laura, but I enjoy being, and she has previously won that award. Where I work has won that award 3 years in a row. I was the third, which means I work somewhere that is good as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's, as I say, unsung hero feels like it carries a bit more weight to it, because it means you're good at the bits that are thankless. And you're good at them regardless. You know, it's not about praise. In many ways, winning that award is a contradiction in itself. It's not about the praise. It's about being good at the job, you know, and enjoying it. Yeah, so I won that. I don't make a fuss of it unless I'm asked. And then I will talk to you about how great I am for 10 minutes. That's what we've just learned today.
No, but I think that that's good, because everybody, look, at some point, everybody would like to be recognized for doing a good job. Like, we all have that inside of us. We would like to know that we are doing a good job, whether it's from our superiors, depending on what kind of work you do, or from your clients. And especially something where you know that it came from the clients, that feels particularly lovely.
Yeah, it was the fact that there were clients who nominated me that made me happiest, definitely. You know, so it was a really lovely experience all around. It was quite overwhelming when I actually won. I was not expecting that at all. I just went for the buffet, but it all just went really well. What can I say?
That conversation was great, and it was a little bit of a challenge for me because I wanted to keep jumping in with my own experiences taking care of my mom, but I knew that what Mike had to say was way more important. Don't forget to tune in next week for part two of this conversation. We've got a lot more to cover on this topic. If you'd like to get in touch with me in the meantime, you can get at me on Twitter, @TheLadyJSays. You can find me on Instagram, @TheLadyJSlays, or you can email me at TheLadyJSays@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe or follow us on your preferred podcasting platform. This way you won't miss any episodes, and you definitely don't want to miss next week's part two of talking to Mike, the carer. I'll see you all back here next Wednesday. Bye.